You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
Good evening and welcome to Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Ladaris Cordell, and tonight it's my pleasure to be in conversation with Shane Bauer. Shane is an outstanding investigative journalist, and he's currently writing for Mother Jones, where his 2016 piece on the 4 months he spent as a private prison guard first debuted. It won a national magazine award and was the most read piece in the history of Mother Jones. That piece led to his newest book, American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. His unique insight into the private prison system from the inside out, coupled with his journalistic chops, make for an incredible portrait of the face of a facet of our criminal justice in America. Before I go into our questions tonight, Shane, I just want everybody to know, in the New York Times book review this past Sunday, Shane's book is on the cover. They write about it there. It's just tremendous. Congratulations.
Thanks.
It's awesome. He's a terrific writer. So let's turn to some questions, Shane. So, Shane, I read the book, and I found this book has just everything. It's got history, you've got suspense, it's got violence, it's got sex, it's got drama, just lots of drama in it. And you tell an amazing story about a subject that most of us know very little about. But after reading this book, you'll know a whole lot more, all of you. So, Shane, why did you want to go undercover as a private prison guard, and how did your spouse, your wife, feel about this?
I decided to go undercover because I'd been writing about prisons for a few years and was kind of constantly frustrated with the difficulty of getting access to prisons. This is not just literally getting inside prisons, but even just getting basic information. We have public records laws. Every state has public records laws and that allow us to get information about prisons, but in many states, the corrections departments don't abide by these laws unless you sue them. And this isn't even kind of close to the level of getting inside and getting a kind of granular look at what life is like inside these prisons. And for private prisons, it is it's even more difficult. You know, these are not public institutions. So often these public records laws don't apply. I thought, okay, let me apply for a job as a way to get inside. And filled out an application on their website.
Did you lie on your application?
No, I didn't lie. I put my name, my personal information.
But your real name?
Yeah. My job history, my current employer.
Mother Jones.
Yeah, I actually put the parent organization of Mother Jones, the Foundation for National Progress.
Okay.
I didn't think it was going to work, really. I was in the office and it took like 2 hours. So I did it. And a couple weeks later, I was getting phone calls with offers for a job.
How did your wife feel about this?
I think a lot of people in my personal life were like, you're going to go back to prison. I had been in prison in Iran for a couple years.
So why don't you talk about that just for a second?
I had been in prison for 2 years in Iran. I was working in the Middle East. And
you were one of the three, right?
Yeah,
you all were hiking.
Three of us. There was Josh Patel and Sarah Shord.
Right.
I was living in Damascus, took a trip to Iraqi Kurdistan, which was considered safe for tourists. I wasn't actually there reporting. We just kind of took a trip for a week, and we were near a local tourist site. It was a waterfall, a lot of Kurdish families kind of camping out, and we went for a hike. and unknowingly got near the Iranian border and saw a soldier who called us to him. And we thought that he was an Iraqi Kurdish soldier, but it turned out he was Iranian. And we got to him. In doing so, we crossed the border. And that led to more than 2 years in prison. So, you know, when I got back, I had thought I would eventually go back to the Middle East. During the time that I was in prison, the Arab Spring erupted. I had been living in Syria. I speak Arabic. And, you know, thought I would eventually go back. But there was a huge hunger strike in California prisons in 2011 when I got out, where there were reports of 30,000 prisoners on hunger strike protesting use of long-term solitary confinement. I'd been in solitary, I'd been on hunger strike, so I kind of jumped in. That was my first project, and I just kind of from there got pulled deeper and deeper into the U.S. prison system.
Wow. You write that private prisons are not a recent phenomenon, and they've been around for several years. And I have to emphasize, this is the most terrific history you can read about the private prison system. You some of the stuff in it, and we'll get to it, is just absolutely mind-boggling. So can you give us just, you know, in a couple of minutes, just a brief history of these private prisons?
How far back do you want to go?
Well, how about Mr. Beasley?
Hutto?
Yeah.
Okay. So this company that that I write about, the Corrections Corporation of America, it's now called CoreCivic, started in the 1980s. And after I did the article for Mother Jones, I started doing kind of deeper research into the founders of the company. And I found that one of the three co-founders, Teraldon Hutto, started his career on running a prison plantation in Texas. He was the warden of a plantation called Ramsey in 1967. It was the size of Manhattan. Prisoners were forced to pick cotton. And he lived on the plantation. He had houseboys.
Who were inmates.
Inmates who served him and his family.
Just like back in slavery.
Yeah. And I saw, you know, in my research, I found the regulations about houseboys at the time. And it really echoed the kind of, you know, the fears of that slave owners had of their house slaves. Like, you know, Hutto's wife was not allowed to be overly familiar with them. The houseboy would wash the family's laundry, but was not allowed to wash her underwear. They had to, you know, couldn't sit with the family and listen to the radio for fear it would lead to impertinence. And Hutto went on to run other plantations. He ran them at a profit, and he eventually started CCA. It was kind of a new chapter in for-profit prisons. But, you know, it really goes back to, like, the beginning of this country. I mean, the very first penitentiaries were for-profit. They were essentially factories. Also, after the Civil War, prison systems throughout the South were all privatized. Prisoners were put in labor camps where they would work for companies. Sometimes they were plantations. Sometimes they were in coal mines. Sometimes they were building railroads. And in all of the historical research I did, the thing that was the most shocking to me was that the prison system in the South for the decades after the Civil War was more deadly than slavery was. Depending on the state, the death rate of the annual death rate ranged between 16% and 25% a year. This is roughly comparable to the death rate of the Soviet gulags.
Wow. Why did you choose Winn Prison, W-I-N-N, in Louisiana?
When I filled out my application, I kind of just, there's a list of prisons run by the company. I just kind of checked some fairly randomly. And once I had a bunch of offers, I was in the end deciding between a prison in Oklahoma and this prison in Louisiana. And there were a couple of reasons I chose Winn. One was that Louisiana at the time was had the highest rate of incarceration in the entire world.
Louisiana.
So, yeah. So, you know, it was kind of like I'm getting inside a prison system. Also, this place that, you know, has just an astronomical rate of incarceration. There were some legal reasons. Oklahoma, apparently corporations have privacy rights. Louisiana, they don't. So, you know, it was kind of like the lawyers at some point really were had their hands in you know, things and were making sure I wasn't breaking any laws and that I was kind of making choices that would minimize the chances that Mother Jones would be sued. So Louisiana was also happened to be better for that.
Did Mother Jones get sued?
No. Although this company threatened to sue several times between the time that I left the prison and we published about a year later, and they had sent us threatening letters several times.
Got it. So can you describe Wynn Prison for us?
Wynn is a medium security prison. It's the oldest medium security private prison in the country.
What do we mean, medium security?
Medium security, so prisons generally are kind of ranked minimum, medium, and high. And there's this kind of other category that some people call supermax, which is mostly solitary confinement.
Like Pelican Bay.
Yeah. Medium, the range of people that were in the prison could be people that were there for too many DUIs, people there for rape, selling drugs. There were some people who had been convicted of murder who had kind of worked their way down the security levels for good behavior or something like that. So it was a pretty, pretty significant mix.
So, but how many inmates?
1,500. 1,500 inmates, guards. I would go in every day, and we had a meeting in the morning, and I would count how many guards were there every day. And it was like usually around 24, 25, 26 guards.
And the racial makeup of the inmates, 1,500?
Inmates were about 75% black and most like 24, 25% white. There were a few.
And the ethnicity of the guards?
The guards were mostly black and mostly women.
Mostly women.
Yeah.
Interesting. We'll
and there were a lot of single moms that were there. The guards generally were poor people from the town. And I had some cadets in my class who were single moms who, you know, basically needed health insurance for their kids. So they were willing to take this $9 an hour job as a prison guard.
How profitable was CCA, now Civic Corps?
Core Civic.
Core Civic. How profitable?
They are a $1.4 billion company. Private prison industry in general is about $4 billion a year industry.
Because right, you write in the book, I believe you said that the salary, the CEO of
right.
CCA, his salary was 20 times the salary of the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Yeah. Yeah, and even people that just sit on the board, you know, they get paid over $100,000 a year. Thurgood Marshall Jr. Happens to be on the board.
So I saw that, and I was like, excuse me? Thurgood Marshall's son is on the board of this private prison corporation.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I emailed him a few times and tried to talk to him about it, and he declined. I went to the shareholder meeting. I bought a single share so that I could go.
That's how you end the book. It's great. Yeah. It's great. So why don't you tell what happened?
He was there.
Yeah. But, you asked questions, didn't you?
Because that was the thing, because they would not talk to me. So this was my chance to kind of see these people and also be able to ask questions, because you have a right as a shareholder to ask questions.
So you bought one share.
I bought one share for like $30-some and flew to Nashville. I had also tried to interview Hutto, and he had initially agreed, but then backed down. So I saw him there, talked to him for a second, and he just kind of brushed me off. I went inside. It was very clear that they knew I was coming. There was a guy there that was just standing behind me the entire time who also had been at Wynn when I was there. And it was, you know, it was kind of a... These meetings are very kind of pro forma. They're not revealing anything. It's almost all board members and executives. I basically told them I'm the guy who worked at Wynn. I cited a bunch of government studies about private prisons and, just kind of asked them, like, why is this? These problems have been repeating for years. Why? Also, how do you justify paying your staff the rate of fast food workers, you know, these people that are risking their lives every day?
Was it like $9 an hour?
Yeah. The prison was kind of in competition with the local Walmart for, I remember when Walmart raised their wages cross country, and my coworker that day, I heard about it from him because he was like, you know, Walmart went up 50 cents. Maybe we should go there.
Wow. Amazing. What kind of oversight is there for CCA-run prisons? I mean, are they regulated at all by the states or federal government? And how are they held accountable other than by having journalists write exposés?
Yeah, I mean, this is an important point, is these companies, they're private companies, but they're still doing work for the states.
Right.
You know, it is 100% states' responsibility what's happening in these places. States are responsible for, and they have contracts with the companies, and they're responsible for enforcing those contracts. At Wynn, the company was not meeting its requirements on many levels, including staffing. And I know in some states they will have actual staff from, you know, people from the Department of Corrections in the prisons. At Wynn, they didn't. But the prison was kind of melting down while I was there, and it became very chaotic. And the state did take over for a week, which was a really interesting experience, partially because just the way that that prisoners related to the state guards was completely different
right.
than how they relate to the private
You're
prison
right
guards.
Right about that.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
And as soon as they left, you know, it was kind
right.
of like
back to
back, yeah.
yeah. Did you wear a wire?
I had a $35 watch I bought from the internet that was a camera and a little pen that recorded audio. So I would basically record audio the whole time I was there so that I
With
could...
With the pen?
Yeah, I just left it on. So, you know, because I couldn't take notes constantly, obviously, although in class I did, and I was the only one taking notes, so I really stood out, but I wanted to be able, you know, not to have to rely on my memory, and I wanted what I wrote to be exactly what people said. So in the book, the quotations of the book are all literally what the people said.
Well, so when you enter a prison, generally mm-hmm. you go through a metal detector,
yeah, yeah.
even the people who work there.
Yeah.
So did you have a concern about getting the recording device?
I did, yeah, yeah. I was very nervous the first time I did it. But I noticed that I had this coworker who had like a pen with a flashlight on it, and I saw him putting it through the x-ray, and they would never ask him about it. So I thought, okay, they're not really paying attention to the, you know, the electronics inside of his pen or whatever. So I put it through the first time, nothing happened, and then I just bring it
wow.
every time.
So what did you wear? Did you look the part?
Yeah, yeah. We had uniforms, you know, it's kind of standard CCA uniform.
But did you change your
expression?
Oh, I did.
I grew a goatee.
You did?
And, you know, they made me take these plugs out of my ears.
You wore them there?
No, I couldn't.
You took it out before you?
Yeah, yeah. They were not allowed. But yeah, I mean, there was this constant process when I was in there of a lot of that job. And I think a lot of being in prison, whether you're a prisoner or a guard, is about fronting, and it's very psychological. So there's this kind of balance that I was trying to figure out how to walk between, you know, I didn't want to be a guard, really. Like, I kind of thought I'd go in and just be like easygoing, whatever, stay out of people's way. But you also have to kind of, you know, if you have to draw a line somewhere, and then once you do that, you have to defend it again for prisoners or guards. Otherwise, you know, once you kind of have people have the sense that they can push you around, then things are not good. So, so you kind of have to have this kind of like tough demeanor.
Well, were you the size you are now when you
pretty
picked?
Much, yeah.
So you toughened up.
I mean, I just I tried to, yeah.
All right.
Prisoners would often comment about how I walked, which, you know, I never paid any attention to.
Like what? What would they say?
So we had to do count every day, like multiple times a day. We have to go through. So they live in dorms, basically. It's like 44 guys in a dorm. So you have to walk up the middle and count them on their beds. And it ended up becoming this thing every day where I would just get catcalled, you know, people were saying, oh, I'm not going to tell you what they said, but, you know, so I start like really paying attention to how I walked, and I would like literally go be in the gym and like walk back and forth in front of the gym and like, okay, what are they saying here? And I would like really try to walk tough, you know?
I'm just reminded of the film La Cage aux Folles, and so the two men, they're both gay, and they were trying to, one was trying to teach the other how to walk straight, like walk, and they had to go to practice to try to walk. And didn't you, didn't they think you were gay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Prisoners at sometimes like pulled me aside and would ask me. I got propositioned by prisoners.
Really?
I had particularly had trouble with prisoners who had asked me if I was gay, and when I told them I wasn't, I had a particular type of tension with those people after.
Really?
And, you know, there was, like, sex between guards and prisoners was not uncommon in the prison, men and women. So they were just checking, I guess.
You volunteered to be tear gassed.
I didn't. I guess, yeah. So, I don't know if I would say volunteered, but I guess.
So what happened? Just kind of.
In training, we had to volunteer to be tear gassed. We had to sign a paper saying we were doing this voluntarily, but they told us we were going to be fired that day. So
it's not exactly volunteer,
yeah.
Right?
But, you know, I think the idea was that we might be in a situation where tear gas is used, and they didn't want us to kind of freak out. They wanted us to know what it felt like. So we went outside, all the cadets, and linked arms, and they just, like, tear gassed us.
What was that like?
It was awful. I mean, you feel like you're, like, choking. You feel like you're going to die, and then eventually it goes away.
And that was it.
But it also kind of, I think, started this sense of camaraderie between the cadets in a way. Like, things really shifted at that point. It was the beginning of this feeling like, okay, we're on this team. We're in this together. We're the ones that are going to have each other's backs. And, you know, that's kind of in the prison. You know, I wouldn't describe the relationship between the guards and the prisoners as like always hostile. In fact, like sometimes guards and prisoners were bonding about their kind of shared disdain for the company. Some knew each other from childhood. But, you know, in the end, whatever you think of the guards, like there was this guard who I met who had told me that he started this job because he was let go from his last job at a juvenile detention center because he uppercutted a 16-year-old kid and shattered his jaw. So, you know, I was like, okay, I don't like this guy. But I also called him once on the radio when I needed backup, you know, in these moments where you feel like you're in danger, you kind of just, like, that stuff doesn't matter. Even if you are thinking, you have these kind of critical thoughts of particular people or of the system, you're still forced into a situation where you have to fall back on just what's available.
Wow. You, as a guard at Wynn, you learned some new terms, such as free people, green dots, shakedown. So what are free people in a private prison?
Free people are people who are not prisoners. Prisoners and guards both use this word. Or the free world, they would talk about. They would say things like free people food, you know, which is not prison food, basically.
Green dots?
Green dots were a type of money card. And it was a kind of popular type of currency in the prison among prisoners, contraband currency. It was a way that people could use actual money. So if somebody had a cell phone, a contraband cell phone, they could, you know, get transfer money to accounts or just handing the numbers back and forth. And we would find these sometimes, these numbers. It's just written on a piece of paper, 10 digits. And when we were cadets, we would have to search people's stuff. And at one time, the guy that was kind of leading us in the search found green dots. And at the end of the day, he was just handing them to the cadets, you know, just basically giving us the money.
Got it. So I asked you another term with shakedowns, and you write about what happened when you did your first shakedown. So I'm going to read what you wrote, just the lead-in, and then I'd like you to tell everybody what you did.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So here's what you wrote. I bend over and feel around a water fountain. My hand lands on something loose. I get on my knees to look. It's a smartphone. I don't know what to do. Do I take it or do I leave it? My job, of course, is to take it. But as a former prisoner, I suddenly feel like the worst kind of snitch. But the question of whether or not to take the phone is also a practical one. I know by now that being a guard is only partially about enforcing the rules. Mostly, it's about learning how to get through every day safely, which requires that decisions like these be weighed carefully. A prisoner is watching me. If I leave the phone, everyone on the tier will know. I will win inmates' respect. But if I take it, I will show my superiors I'm doing my job. What did you do?
I took the phone. That was really, that was to me a kind of really defining moment of my time there, because I thought of myself and still think of myself as a former prisoner. And that was when it really kind of hit me that, okay, I'm not just like wearing a prison guard costume, I'm a guard. And, you know, when I went in there, I kind of was committed to doing the job the way that I was supposed to do it. But I didn't really think of these kind of moments where, you know, if I was a prisoner and I found a phone, I would have taken it and I would have never snitched on another prisoner that had a phone. But you know, and when I did take it, I had a lot of problems with the prisoners for a while. You know, they all knew I took it. There was a prisoner there watching me. But it did also shift my relationship with my supervisors, which for me, being undercover, you know, helped. It also was showing them that I was doing the job the way I was supposed to. And an interesting kind of coda to that story is that after I left the prison, the company did an investigation. They sent someone from the corporate office to investigate me and what I had done there, basically. So they took everything I had written, every disciplinary report, and one of them was involving that phone.
Can you tell us what a disciplinary report is?
Yeah, if a prisoner breaks a rule, basically, a guard has the option to write him up. Yeah,
but it's an option.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. I mean, practically, it's an option. You can't. People are breaking rules every minute, so it's kind of a thing that you do if you feel like you know, you need to kind of push back against a prisoner in a way, and or you find like contraband. So you find a phone, you have to write a report. So they found this report. They had interviewed one of the supervisors who I later spoke to, and they were insinuating. She says that they were insinuating to her that that I had brought the phone in. So they tried to find the phone, but the phone was gone because apparently a guard had taken the phone and sold it back to a prisoner. I mean, of course, all the phones, they come from guards. You know, guards are bringing, they're making $9 an hour. They're trying to, you know, supplement their income. So some of them will sell phones or drugs.
Wow. So at Wynn, you write that you and your colleagues were required, part of the training, I guess, to take a personality test.
Yeah.
And was it administered by a psychologist?
No.
No? So the test was called True Colors.
Yeah.
So what were your true colors? Tell us about it.
So this is a test that, I don't know, some company came up with it, and you basically like reduces your people into four personality types, four colors.
Four colors.
I think it was gold, orange, green, and blue, maybe. So most of the people in the prison ended up being gold, which is like, you know, you follow rules, kind of order. And then there's like blues who are, I think there were blues that were kind of like sympathetic. One of the interesting things about this test is that you know, generally people kind of, if they retest, they'll always have the same personality type. But they told us in training that they find that people often get more gold traits after they work in the prison. So they become more of kind of the, you know, order, strict discipline people. And my colors, I'm trying to remember the codes. I think it was green and orange. It was like, I think the first one was like analytical and curious or something like that. And yeah, they, when I took the color, they were like, oh, we never have those here. But the company also used this test, to place people, you know, on, different positions in the prison.
So when you took the test, you were then placed where?
I was put in a unit called ASH. All the units were named after trees. It was one of the, there were five units in the prison. This was kind of not the most difficult, but one of the more difficult units. So there's kind of, while it's a medium security prison, every unit also has in some ways a security level. So people can work their way down to Dogwood, which they have a few more privileges like extra TV time and stuff. Generally a calmer unit. So I was in ASH. I worked with another guard, mostly the same guy every day, named Dave Bakel. He was a man in his 60s, retired from the Coast Guard, trying to supplement his income. And it was just me and him and a person kind of in this control room, but just me and him actually on the floor interacting with prisoners, letting them out, 350 prisoners.
Just the two of you?
Yeah.
350?
Yeah.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
Okay. Did you become close to any of the guards such that you might have confided in any of them about what you were up to?
No. I mean, you know, I spent 12 hours a day with Bakel, as I called him. And we spent a lot of time talking.
What'd they call you? What did he call you?
Bauer. You know, we don't use first names. Often I didn't know the first names of the other guards. You know, he would talk about his time in the Coast Guard, like, endlessly. He talked about, like, Civil War reenactments he would go to. You know, that kind of stuff. I didn't try not to tell him, or the guards in general, too much about myself. There were times that, you know, I would slip a little bit. Like, in training, I talked about, like, backpacking in the Sierras and this other cadet was like, why the hell are you here? You know, why did you come to this $9 an hour job in Louisiana? And I would just, you know, just say, like, I think that time I just said, like, you never know where life's going to take you. And then they just kind of like, don't really press further.
What about inmates? Did you have any kind of a, you know, close relationship or just a relationship with some of the inmates? Cause you have names and you're like Tattoo Face, Gray yeah. Shirt, Corner Store.
Yeah, there were prisoners that I did have a type of relationship with. I mean, I don't think you can really call a relationship between prisoner and a guard a friendship, but there were people that I would talk to a lot, and you know, a lot of guards would, like, you know, in the down times, guards will just kind of like lean up against the bars and be chatting with a prisoner. Corner Store was a guy who. When I first start working there, I noticed that Bakel would let this guy out of his dorm, which you weren't really supposed to do. Like, he would do it not in times that we're letting everyone out to go eat or something. Mm-hmm. And he would let this guy out, and he would basically go kind of ferry things between prisoners. So, like, a prisoner would
What kind of things?
Like, a prisoner would say, hey, I want to trade this honey bun for some cigarettes. So go send this honey bun to that guy. And he would take it and go to the other dorm and make the trade. And in doing that, they would give him kickbacks. And he, you know, he'd been in prison for like over 20 years. He didn't have anybody outside sending money to his commissary. So this is how he would get commissary. And for us, he helped us because he, you know, prisoners would often kind of try to come up with some excuse for us to let them out so they could do exactly that. So in him doing that, it kind of put the pressure off us to have to deal with all these requests. And there were, so, you know, I would chat with him a lot. But there are a lot of prisoners that really fill these roles in more official ways also. And this is not just in private prisons, this is throughout the prison system. Prisons would not run if it wasn't for prison labor.
This is true of the state prisons?
Yeah, all prisons. You know, prisoners are janitors, they cook the food, they do the laundry, do administrative work. In the prison I was in, there were inmates who were training chase dogs. There was an inmate who would send out into the woods, and he would climb up a tree to get like chased by the dogs, and he would wear a bite suit so the dogs would like jump on him and try to bite him. Which didn't always work. There was a prisoner, they showed me a picture of a guy who had like a hole in his throat who had been bit.
So I've mentioned about how rich this book is with history, that it's stunning. And I want to read just one passage from your book and then ask you a question. You write this: in Louisiana, black women were mixed with male prisoners and some became pregnant. In 1848, legislators passed a new law declaring that all children born in the penitentiary of African Americans serving life sentences would become property of the state. The women would raise the kids until the age of 10, at which point the penitentiary would place an ad in the newspaper. 30 days later, the children would be auctioned on the courthouse steps, cash on delivery. The proceeds were used to fund schools for white children. And many of these children, black children, were purchased by prison officials. I have no words. So do you have any words?
I mean, I don't know. There are so many gruesome parts of this history. That one was particularly dark.
I've never heard this. I just haven't.
I hadn't either.
It was a revelation to me when I read it. But.
Yeah. You know, the thing about the prisons at that time in the South, and one of the reasons that actually the South was initially resistant to the idea of opening prisons, was that prisons, the people who would be going to prisons, this is before the Civil War, would mostly be white. Because African Americans were mostly enslaved and were being punished on their plantations. So the idea of, and prisons at the time, you know, in the North, were prisoners were all forced into labor. That was what you did if you were a prisoner. You were laboring for private contractors. So it would mean that white people would be essentially reduced to the status of slaves. So Southern states were resistant to it for a long time. But Louisiana in particular had women who would end up in the prison. Many of them, I think most of them, were imprisoned for trying to kill or somehow harm their slave owners. It's basically just records. There's very little information about these people. There's one question is who's impregnating them? I mean, they were in prison with other men, but, this kind of, women prisoners, becoming pregnant is still a thing that happens. There were actually guards, women guards who had children of inmates also. This point of the kind of where the state is stepping in and selling slaves was
amazing. So you write in your book, and I'd just like you to tell us who is saying this and why. You write, this person is saying this: hell, if you got a problem with a midget, call me. I'll help you. me and you can whoop the hell out of him. But if we are going to hit an inmate, we should make sure to do it before he's cuffed, he tells us. Because once the cuffs are on, the window to retaliate is closed. But if you see me doing it, mind your own business. Who said this and why?
This guy was the head of the prison's special operations response team. It's sort of a...
like a SWAT team?
Yeah, it's like a SWAT team for the prison. He was our instructor a lot during training. He also... He I think maybe that same day, he had asked us, what we do if we see two inmates fighting? My natural response is, we break it up. That's like literally what our job is. And he says, no. You know, our job is to shout at them, stop fighting. And we should not get in the middle of it. He says, we do not pay you that much. He says, the next... raise you get is not going to be much more than the one you got last time. And our job is to go home at the end of the day. And he says, if those fools want to cut each other, then happy cutting. And, you know, this is more than just this guy being brutal. There's a kind of theme that came up over and over again that was kind of about liability for the company. They told us in class that part of our job was to deliver value to our shareholders. And that for us, as low-level guards, this meant making sure we do the bare minimum that we're supposed to do, like tell them to stop, because that can be entered in a lawsuit, that can be used as evidence. But we don't want to get hurt in a way that is going to cost company money. And, you know, we don't have anything. We just have radios. We literally don't have anything. I did see people stab each other. And
with what?
With homemade knives, shanks. They made out of metal from their beds or something like that.
And you're not carrying any weapons?
No. And actually, the radios were new just before I started there. They gave the radios to the guards. So a few months before I started there, there was literally nothing.
What percentage, and I'm going to make an assumption, that there were some inmates at Wynn who were mentally ill?
Yeah.
Do you have a notion of what percentage of the inmates were mentally ill and what support system was there for inmates who were mentally ill?
I don't remember what the percentage was, but it was high. I think it was maybe a third, and had some mental health issues that were somehow diagnosed. The support system consisted of one full-time social worker and one part-time psychiatrist.
For 1,500 inmates?
Yeah. Which was significantly less than the other, prisons in the state. My only direct interaction with the kind of mental health services at Wynn was when I had to sit on suicide watch. My
what
first day on the
like?
Job.
Yeah, what was that like?
So suicide watch is solitary confinement. If somebody says that he is suicidal, he gets put in a suicide watch cell by himself. He
What's
has no,
the cell
no clothes.
Look like?
It's, I don't know, I would say a 6-foot by 6-foot cell. No mattress. There's like a metal bunk. He's given a tear-proof blanket, but has no clothes and nothing in the cell, no books. He's actually given worse food than the other prisoners. He gets a brown bag lunch, the caloric value of which is below USDA standards for, a sedentary adult male. So I sat there my first day on the job, actually, 12 hours. My job is to sit and just watch the two cells in front of me and every 15 minutes kind of note what they're doing.
So you can see right?
Yeah, I'm sitting directly across from them.
And they're, what is
just
it?
Bars.
Just the bars.
And plexiglass. The prisoners did not want me sitting there. One guy was... for most of the day, just staring at me and masturbating and telling me if he didn't like it, I should just move. So that sucked.
Did you move? Did you move?
I had to sit there. That was
you
my
sat
job.
There and
yeah.
just watched him masturbate.
Yeah, I mean, I tried not to watch him, but he. I would tell him to stop, and it was just this kind of dynamic where he would just, it would make him do it more. And then there's this other guy whose name is Damien Costley, who also didn't want me sitting there. You know, he's telling me, get the hell out of here. He says, if you don't move, I'm going to jump on my, get up on the top bunk and jump down and break my neck. And so I, you know, reported it, which I'm supposed to do because he's threatening to hurt himself. And like psychiatrist comes like 6 hours later. And when I left, oh, and by the way, they told us in training that if somebody is there on suicide watch for 48 hours, then they have to get permission from the local corporate office to keep them there. And part of the issue is that it costs a lot of money to have people on suicide watch because the ratio is one guard to two inmates as opposed to one guard is 175. And she told us in training, the social worker, that part of the reason for the sparse conditions of suicide watch is to deter people from going there because it's costly. But Damien, after I left, a while after I left prison, it had become known that I was a journalist, and I got contacted by an attorney who said that her client wanted to speak to me. So the client was Damien's mom, and she asked me if I had known him. I told her I guarded him once, and she said that he committed suicide. I went back to Louisiana and met her. She had all of his files. She let me look through them. And I learned from those that he had been on hunger strike many times to demand better mental health services. He was in prison for shooting and killing a man. And he was racked with guilt about it. He had confided in other prisoners saying that he was thinking about committing suicide. He told a psychiatrist he'd been hearing voices, and he was really trying to pressure the company for better mental health services, and he didn't get them. He hanged himself, and when the time that he died, he weighed 71 pounds. And I later did a records request with the Department of Corrections asking them how many prisoners had committed suicide in that prison that year, and they said zero. Now, the company claims that their rate of suicide is lower than it is in public prisons. What happened in Damien's case is he hanged himself. He did not die immediately, but he was unconscious. And they sent him to a hospital where he remained for 5 days. And in that time, the warden granted him a compassionate release. So he was not in the custody of the company when he died.
Okay. So Shane, there's this one passage in your book, and I'd like you to just talk to us about it, so maybe this will take us to the questions. You write this about being a guard. It's getting in my blood. The boundary between pleasure and anger is blurring. To shout makes me feel alive. I take pleasure in saying no to prisoners. I like to hear them complain about my write-ups. I like to ignore them when they ask me to cut them a break. I feel a thrill when they shout from down the tier as I confiscate their stuff. I hoped the sort team would come in and gas the whole unit. All that matters anymore is action. So this is what you were thinking. This is what you were feeling. What had you become?
Towards the end of my time there, I had this kind of dual life in a lot of ways where I would go home and I would be, you know, kind of my normal self. I would be writing, but I would be dealing with the tension from the prison. I was drinking more. But inside, I was just a prison guard, and I had become really authoritarian. I had become kind of obsessed with the battles that I had with particular prisoners. So I would go home and feel kind of ashamed of this person. You know, I would listen to the audio, hear myself shouting, and then the longer I was there, when I was inside, I was thinking less and less about my job as a reporter and more about this kind of like very complex web of power and where I fit in it and who I had to worry about, when I had to watch my back, who I wanted to punish.
You were offered a promotion, right?
I was, yeah.
You did your job so well.
apparently, wow. Yeah.
Wow. So it's time now to turn to our wonderful audience here. And if you have a question for Shane, just step up to the microphone. For all of you who want to ask questions, let me just give you this one. I have only one directive, and it's the same one I gave to lawyers who would come into my courtroom over a period of 20 years. And it's the rule of the three B's. Be clear, be brief, be seated. All right? So go ahead.
My name is Bob Burnside, and I was wondering if you know anything about the contracts worth many millions of dollars that are given to private prison companies to house immigrants and their separated children.
Thank you.
Actually, the immigrant detention is kind of the frontier of these companies. While private prison companies control about 8% of the prison population, they control about 2/3 of the immigrant detainee population. The Obama administration a few weeks after my article came out, announced that that the federal government was going to stop using private prisons. The stock price of the company tanked. It fell by half. But at the same time, during that time, he also granted a $1 billion no-bid contract for a detention center in Texas. There was a family detention center. When Trump won the election, the day that he won, the stock price rose more than any company in the stock market, probably because of the assumption that he would be even tougher on detaining immigrants.
And I my understanding is that 73% of immigrants who are detained are in private prisons.
Yep.
73%. And what percentage of inmates who are not immigrants are in private prisons?
It's about 8%.
8%. Yep. Right. So the big business is the immigrant business.
Yep.
Now for private prisons. Amazing. Another question?
What's the difference in everyday life between state prisons and private prisons? And are there private prisons for incarcerated women?
Thank you.
There are women in private prisons. I haven't been in them. As far as the difference, I want to be clear that the purpose of writing this book about private prisons, is not to say that the kind of current state of public prisons is like the goal that, of kind of rehabilitation and conditions or whatever. And many of the things that I write about, you could see in a public prison, sexual abuse, violence. But there are particular issues with private prisons. I think they come down to violence. They tend to be more violent. And this is true of Wynn, but it has also been borne out by studies by the Department of Justice. This has a lot to do with staffing. Lower staffing levels, kind of generally lower morale of guards. Healthcare tends to be a lot worse. I met a guy who lost his legs and fingers to gangrene in the prison, who had been complaining for months about pain so bad he couldn't sleep, and he wanted to go to the hospital, and they would not take him. It's contract to the state. If the company sent a prisoner to a hospital, it would have to foot the bill. So, there's reluctance to do that. The other big difference is programs that are offered. There tends to be less in private prisons for, rehabilitative programs or vocational programs.
What about women?
There are women.
For women?
Yeah. But I have not been to them, and I don't know a lot about them.
Another question?
Hi. So I was wondering, where is there more respect for human dignity, in a prison in Iran or in Louisiana?
Good question. Thank you.
I think is not really a possible question to fully answer, but it's hard to say like what's better because they're different. The prison that I was in Iran, at least the section of the prison I was in, was a political prison. People were physically tortured there. I was in prison with a lot of pro-democracy activists. When we left our cells, we were blindfolded. We were not allowed to interact with other prisoners. And the a win where Evin, the prison in Iran, was kind of highly controlled. Win was the opposite. You know, it was very bare bones, chaotic. There was a lot of violence between prisoners. At Evin, there wasn't. You know, I mean, it's hard to say, like, you know, you have a place where interrogators are torturing someone. Is that worse, or is it worse when you put somebody in solitary confinement for 20 years? You know, they're both terrible things. And Iran is not putting people in solitary confinement for 20 years. But, you know, we don't have the same kind of, like, political prison here either.
Hi there. I've learned a lot tonight, so thank you. As a citizen in San Francisco and someone who's registered to vote, what is the most impactful way to have a positive impact on the system? I know people who volunteer and teach inmates to code, and then one day if they're, you know, able to leave prison, then they can maybe be more equipped to enter back into the job force or to get a job. But curious your thoughts on, like, how to impact change.
Thank you.
People always ask me that question. I never know how to answer it. I mean, I guess I would say that there are a lot of people doing a lot of work on prisons and a lot of activists. And that is not, you know, my thing. I kind of just try to write about how terrible it is. But I know that specifically with private prisons, there have been divestment movements. I'm not sure what's happening around here. But there are organizations working on all aspects of prison, whether it's you know, people getting out of prison, transitioning. There's a great organization in San Francisco called Legal Services for Prisoners with Children that does a lot of really important work, not just for prisoners with children, but also people in solitary confinement. There are organizations sending books to prisoners, which is not, you know, something that's going to necessarily change the system, but it does really impact prisoners' lives. But, you know, these groups that are doing stuff are pretty easy to find online. So, you know, I think if you look, you'll find.
But one thing I want to follow up on.
Yeah.
You said when we talked for a bit before we came out, when you were in prison in Iran, that you were able to get books.
Yeah.
And you said there was a book in particular that gave you hope.
Yeah, it was the autobiography of Frederick Douglass. It was kind of like, you know, reading about this person whose situation was much, much, much worse than mine. He was enslaved, who just, he had such a huge impact, you know, on that institution. There were things that he did while he was enslaved that were really inspiring and actually really kind of tangibly impacted my own situation in prison, where, you know, he writes about this time that he got into this fight with his slave driver, and it's like this long thing, and then after that, you know, he never has problems with him or whatever. And after reading that, I really kind of changed how I interacted with guards and how I held myself, would kind of push against them in a certain way. And it not only changed how I felt about myself in the prison, but it also changed how they dealt with me. So yeah, that book I could not recommend enough.
Oh.
Also, just books in prisons. I mean, for prisoners, it's very little that's more important than that, honestly.
Why do you think that private prison reform isn't talked about more often in our mainstream political discourse by really?
I mean, it before Trump was inaugurated, it was actually a part of you know, the presidential debates, including the primary debates. Really, for the first time that I know of, Bernie had initially said that he would abolish private prisons, and then after that, Hillary said the same thing, and then following that, Obama, you know, tried to do that. It comes up on state levels, depending on the state. But, you know, it's in the end, it's still an issue of states trying to save money. And there's, you know, in this long history of prisons in America, there's so many times in American history you see the same debate coming up where, or maybe not a debate, but where people in the public will be writing op-eds and things like this, like saying, you know, how can we monetize punishment? This is, you know, an abomination. And then, you know, the legislators are like, well, it's saving us money. We can't afford to run a prison. So they do it. And this cycle just repeats over and over and over again.
And our last question.
Hi, thank you so much. My question is on accountability. I'm wondering if inmates or inmates' families have successfully been able to sue these prisons when they clearly don't follow the state regulations, or other successful ways these prisons have been held accountable. Basically, what gives you hope?
There have been a lot of successful lawsuits against these companies. But the context of this is that it's very difficult for inmates to sue, especially if they don't have representation. It's nearly impossible to win a lawsuit. But despite that, some do. Usually they don't win, but they force a company to settle, often for medical stuff. A common theme in lawsuits is, there's so many lawsuits where they're complaining that the prison is being run for profitable gain, so they're not doing X thing. And I will say also that even though it's become more difficult for prisoners to successfully sue in recent decades, there is a sense among guards, there is a fear of being sued. So there actually has been an impact, I think, in certain ways of prison litigation. That guards would complain about how, like, back in the day, you could take someone out and back and beat him, and you can't do that anymore.
Right. So that's all of our audience questions. I encourage everybody, please, you have to read this book. And particularly, there's a part of the book at the end where Shane talks about how he got out. It is so suspenseful. So I'm not going to be a spoiler. I will not tell you what happened to him in trying to get out. So Shane, it is the tradition at Inforum to ask all of our speakers one last question. And so this is the final question. And in 60 seconds, what is your idea to change the world?
I always forget about that you guys asked this question. Okay, I guess an obvious one is to abolish private prisons. Ultimately, this is actually a very small step, but I'll talk about this since this is what my book is about. There's no way for these prisons, for these companies to reform in a way that would be anything near what any idea that we have or should have about what punishment leads to can be. The reason is that the margin of profit for these companies is very low. It's very small. And even if states regulated them and to make them basically be at the level of our already dismal public prisons, the whole reason for them existing will be gone. They won't be saving money anymore, you know, because that means they'll have to raise wages, they'll have to, you know, increase staff, they'll have to bring more teachers. So it's built in to the system that they're not going to work. But, you know, ending private prisons is not the end of our problem. Prisons ultimately are the end stage of a much, much larger, more complex problem that has to do with mandatory minimum sentencing, criminalization, length of sentences we're giving, racism in American society, economic inequality. I mean, there's no easy, short answer to how we solve this problem. It's a deep one. Wow.
So Shane Bauer, I thank you on behalf of all of us for being so thoughtful, for being courageous, and for being a writer, and a writer who's trying to have impact, and you have had. And thank you for playing your part in making this world a better place. So I thank you for joining us here tonight at Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I am Ladaris Cordell. Please have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Thank you.